Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. We'll hear from best-selling author CJ Box. He writes stories about wildlife and hunting culture in Wyoming and has thoughts on the recent wolf incident in Sublette County.
A lot of the headlines referred to the guy who killed the wolf as a hunter. That's not hunting.
Wyomingites need solutions for affordable rental housing, and fast. Cheap housing is growing scarce.
New management came in and took over, and they more than doubled my rent.
Preserving posters printed more than 100 years ago can be a challenge. A new exhibit looks at how to ensure the preservation of Buffalo Bill era posters. Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Did you know that all 6 episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
The story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. By now, you've probably heard about the man who brought a wolf into a bar in Daniel, Wyoming. The state fined Cody Roberts $250 in March for possessing a live wolf in Sublette County. Photos and videos show the wolf's mouth taped shut and later muzzled at a local bar, with Roberts posing with it. He later killed the wolf. This sparked international outrage, with people calling it torture and demanding Roberts' arrest. But there's also staunch local support for Roberts. As Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan reports, the back-and-forth hatred is raining down on Wyomingites, most of whom weren't even part of the incident.
Hey, Caitlin.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Hey, my office is back there on the right.
Callie O'Hare is the editor and reporter of the weekly newspaper in Sublette County, the Pinedale Roundup.
What could be more stressful than being a one-woman newspaper and doing nearly everything?
O'Hare's bright eyes jump around from multiple computer screens and a long to-do list. One of the items, follow-up wolf coverage.
And that has been, you know, all-consuming. It is truly one of those, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
She says it's been a gut punch to cover the story. Sublette County is a tight-knit community, and some are pretty protective of the Robertses, a multi-generational family here.
My partner of 11 years grew up with Cody Roberts. We almost lived next to him.
She remembers coming home and telling her partner,
hey, I have to write this article, and it may be hard to read, and it may have blowback.
And it did.
I don't know if it would be helpful to you if I read.
Yeah, please.
O'Hare leafs through some printouts of comments from the Pinedale Roundup Facebook page.
This guy, he works for Road and Bridge. It says, go practice real journalism, Callie O'Hare, you b- on a witch hunt for a man's family.
Another comment from the county treasurer asked O'Hare to stop the coverage, and an employee with planning and zoning accused O'Hare of not being objective.
I'm just doing my job. It's not personal. And I have great empathy for all of the folks involved in this.
O'Hare says she's not threatened for her safety, although she and her partner have lost a lot of friends. But there's a flip side. Hateful comments have also come from wildlife advocates who don't support Roberts. They're accusing him of abusing and torturing the wolf, and they're being really vocal.
My name's Cody Roberts, and I live in Thane, Wyoming.
This isn't the Cody Roberts. He declined an interview. This Cody Roberts lives almost 2 hours away and isn't related. But some people have mistaken his Facebook page for the Cody Roberts.
I mean, I've had death threats from Ireland, Russia, Japan, Australia. I don't know how many thousands of messages I've had. I think I've had 15 this morning.
And some are pretty violent.
Like this one just says, you're a psychopathic wolf torturer, kill yourself.
And it's not just him. His parents' phone number was shared on Facebook, and his wife got messages threatening to rape her. Another message said,
I'll run your grandson over and break his legs.
Robert says he's responded to every single message, explaining that he's not the guy. But some don't accept it.
I mean, one lady even went and said, I don't care if you're not the right one. Do us a favor and put a bullet in his head then, and this will all go away.
Robert says he's also disappointed by what the Cody Roberts did, but he actually thinks this verbal abuse is worse. And now he even has empathy.
Does he deserve everything that he's getting? No, I don't think he does. I think people, you know, he's still a human.
So far, he's not too worried about his family's safety. But there is a group of protesters planning a motorcycle brigade from Texas to Sublette County later this month. And Robert says some of them have sent him violent messages.
I'm sure that some of the people are going to be okay and be peaceable in their protest, but is the entire group going to be that way?
And that's just one of the wolf-related things the local authorities are monitoring. The Sublette County Sheriff's Office is inside a glass door. In a dimly lit basement, Public Information Officer Travis Bingham is hard at work. There's an active investigation into whether Cody Roberts broke any animal abuse laws, but also an unprecedented number of related investigations.
We've had threats on people's lives or their businesses.
And on top of that, they're getting thousands of frustrated calls from around the country, clogging up the 911 phone lines. So they even created a separate tip number.
We still have citizens to serve, and they're still expecting 911 service and police service for other things.
All this global attention and hate, it's mostly behind a keyboard, but not for the locals. Tension is spilling into the bars, grocery store, and post office. Bingham says the focus now is moving forward.
We'll all learn from it and move on.
Part of that moving on is wrapping up the investigation. But Bingham says the timeline at this point is unknown. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Sublette County.
Given the massive backlash and fallout from the wolf killing incident, we wanted to try to better understand the context. Like, how did we get here? Well, part of this is Wyoming has had a long and complicated relationship with wolves. And to try to unpack all that, we're going to turn to Wyomingite and New York Times bestselling author CJ Box. Box has penned 30 novels, many focusing on a fictional Wyoming game warden named Joe Pickett. In writing these books, Box has extensively researched Wyoming's wildlife culture and the jobs of real-life game wardens. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan speaks with Box about his take on the wolf incident.
CJ, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Can you give us your general take on what happened with the wolf incident in Sublette County?
I was kind of shocked by it, actually. I'm aware of wolves, of course, and I know people who have killed wolves, and there have been wolves killed not far from where we live, on the Colorado-Wyoming border. But I was shocked by the cruelty of it and the fact that there were images of the injured wolf all over the internet and went all internationally. Like I said, I was shocked. Not that anyone would kill a wolf, but that they would display an injured animal like that and torture it on a video.
And in your research and just time spent in Wyoming, have you ever heard of something like this happening before, wolves or otherwise?
Actually, no. That's not to say it's never happened before, but I have never heard of someone basically gathering up a severely wounded animal and taking it to a bar and then taking pictures of it and playing with it and torturing it. for the amusement of the people inside. No, I've never heard of that happening.
And then I'm curious if you could kind of talk towards the concept of generally, especially here in Wyoming, why some people maybe do view predators different than prey.
Predators can do harm to livestock and pets and people, whereas prey certainly can't. I mean, it's pretty basic, I think, human reaction that you think differently about an animal that can potentially kill you than one that is likely to run away. I know it goes a lot deeper than that, and everything gets very political and polarizing when it comes to issues like grizzly bears and wolves. And I explore those things in my books and try to do it in a fair and nuanced way. But it's a matter of what can eat you and what you eat.
Right. Well, and as you're saying, it can get so political and emotionally charged. I mean, even before this incident, a lot of people have pushed for Wyoming to reform its laws around wolves. Definitely now post this incident, many groups are more vocal. Just a few examples. So in Wyoming, obviously, we have 85% of the state or so is in the predator zone. And in this area, it's legal to run down and over a wolf with a snowmobile, which is allegedly what happened in this incident. So some want to see that outlawed. Others want to see the wolf put back on the endangered species list, which would hand control over of the wolves from Wyoming to the feds. And then others are angered about that Cody Roberts, the man who allegedly did this, that he was fined $250 for possessing a live warm-blooded animal. And some think it should have been a higher amount or possibly even jail time. CJ, do you have any thoughts on this, or do you think any of these changes would be a good fit for Wyoming?
Well, I know that, I mean, the issue about wolves in Wyoming and in Yellowstone has been controversial since Yellowstones were, quote, reintroduced. It's been controversial for a lot of different reasons. Some people just simply hate the idea of wolves anywhere. Others, and I'm more in this camp, I spent time in Yellowstone Park, and I knew people there who had seen wolves in the park before they were, quote, reintroduced. But then when the federal government decided to add more wolves to that very small population, then that to me seemed like almost like an unnatural act. But I think because they're so controversial and there's been so much laws and discussions about it, I think a pretty good compromise has been reached in the state of Wyoming, where wolves are perfectly fine within the area, greater Yellowstone area, but considered predators outside of that. I think a lot of people weighed in to come to that end decision. It's probably the most practical way to go forward.
And just a reminder to those who are just tuning in, we're speaking with Wyoming author CJ Box on the recent wolf killing incident in Sublette County. CJ, you kind of referenced this earlier. There's a lot of people who don't like wolves. They don't want to see them in Wyoming. Can you speak to that and maybe just get into the thought process there?
There are people who feel like that wolves can threaten them, their kids, their livestock, their pets, and therefore they don't want them around. I think the current laws and regulations in Wyoming are probably the best solution to that, wolves can thrive in certain parts of the state where they've adapted and would be considered predators in other parts where they haven't adapted. I don't have the answers, but I do know it really isn't a black and white issue.
Definitely. And it is so complicated. There is so much anger on both sides, multiple sides of this issue. There is a lot of people who don't live in Wyoming that are chastising the whole state, that are lumping us all into kind of this action of this one person. Can you talk about that and your thoughts on Wyoming's track record of wildlife management?
Well, I think the track record of wildlife management is very good overall. An incident like this tars everyone. It does anger me that a lot of the headlines I saw about this incident referred to the guy who killed the wolf as a hunter. That's not hunting. Every hunter I know of, if they wound something, will try to dispatch that animal as quickly and humanely as possible. Not take it back, not show it off, not take pictures with it. That's not the behavior of a hunter. And it's real very unfortunate that some people paint the entire state of Wyoming as filled with these types of people. I have never met one. I've never met a person who wanted, who really actively seemed to enjoy torturing wildlife.
And you touched on the reintroduction history. I'm wondering if there's anything else you want to add of context to Wyoming's history and culture with wolves and why it is complicated and the different, you know, industries. There's a big agriculture industry in the state as well, and how trying to get all of these things to coexist can be complicated.
It is complicated. It's very complicated, and it gets nuanced. I remember I was at a book signing last year in Dallas, and a woman in the front row said, you know, I hope you don't have wolves do bad things in your books because I love wolves. And, you know, when you're dealing with somebody like that, with that kind of mindset, that they like the idea of wolves, maybe they've never seen one, maybe they've never seen what a wolf could do to a calf or a moose, but just simply loves these creatures almost, it's almost, they think of wolves in a godlike way. That's too far over the to the other side, I think. Wolves are wolves. They're predators. They're carnivores. Wolves will do what wolves do. They won't stop. But if there's, you know, common sense management of wolves, the harm can be mitigated. And I think that's what we've got here. You know, and unfortunately, this incident threw a very, very bad light on the whole thing.
I'm curious, CJ, is there anything you want to add? Like, do you think this will provide any unfortunate fodder for future books for you, or anything else you want to add that we didn't touch on?
I would probably not use this incident in a book, because I would not want locals to be portrayed in that manner, because I don't think... No, I know that most people in Wyoming appreciate the outdoors. Many are hunters. Many may be opposed to wolves, but they don't torture wounded animals. That's not something normal, well-adjusted people do.
And then any speculation or thoughts on how you think this might play out?
Well, you know, I could see a push for stronger fines or penalties for someone who tortures wildlife on screen and broadcasts it. But I also think, you know, there's always the danger of an overreaction to a single incident when it, you know, as far as I know, has never happened before, and I hope would never happen again.
Well, we've been speaking with Wyomingite and New York Times bestselling author CJ Box. CJ, thank you so much for taking the time.
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you.
Affordable housing in the state is getting scarce. Up next, we learn how some are trying to create solutions. This is Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West, we find out all the crazy workarounds people have found for the lack of affordable housing in Jackson.
It's cold when you come back, and the issue then is, like, all your water freezes, and, like, trying to dry ski stuff or anything like that, it's a pain. But once the heaters are going, it gets cranking in here.
Chasing the Dragon. It's episode 4 of our series, High Altitude Tales. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Hi, I'm Grady Kirkpatrick, inviting you to join me for Wyoming Sounds. Along with your favorites, you'll discover plenty of new music. We bring you NPR news updates, weather, and we'll let you know about events happening around Wyoming. Wyoming Sounds from 9 to noon on Wyoming Public Radio and 24/7 online at wyomingsounds.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The demand for affordable housing in Wyoming is ballooning. especially in Cheyenne, where there is expected to be an influx of people moving in to work at software facilities and the local Air Force base. In light of that fact, state agencies, nonprofits, and an interim legislative committee are scrambling to find creative ways of increasing the housing supply. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements reports.
3,100. That's about the number of families waiting on a statewide list for affordable housing vouchers. That wait list has roughly tripled in size in the last 3 years. The Cheyenne Housing Authority distributes the vouchers to subsidize rent for tenants who have a private landlord.
Typically, the wait is a year or more for any voucher that's issued.
Greg Hancock is the Housing Authority's executive director.
There's a tremendous amount of time that's put in to qualify each household prior to the time that they receive a voucher.
Demand is outpacing supply. Until a solution, or more likely, a combination of solutions, is found, Wyomingites will either continue to wait, leave the state, or get lucky and secure housing. Or they'll lose access to shelter altogether. Hancock points to a deficit of housing units and cooperative landlords as two reasons for the waitlist. As it continues to grow, the lack of low-income housing has led some community groups to take matters into their own hands. Camilla Shelter is a homeless residence in Cheyenne. Robin Bacanegra is its director.
Somebody stays in our program for 2 years. They've been sober. They've had the same job. They're ready to go. They're ready to move out. There's nowhere for them to go.
They're trying to solve that problem themselves. About a year ago, Bacanegra says the shelter was given a dilapidated motel by the city of Cheyenne that sits right next door to it. The city purchased it using COVID-era ARPA funds with the intention that the shelter would transform it into individual affordable housing units.
There was a lot of drug traffic. There was actually human trafficking. A lot of criminal activity going on over there that left, I mean, it was very undesirable. Lots of police calls.
So far, 3 units have been built and are currently occupied. 19 additional units are planned for renovation in the coming year. The brown and beige motel forms a horseshoe around an asphalt lot.
You know, Robin told me to make this place my home, so I did. And
Dave Wells is one of the occupants of Stages, named after the motel it replaced, the Stagecoach. He has a bushy white beard and a baseball cap with the American flag.
I got black lights in here, and these are black light posters. And
as he puts it, he's a graduate of the CAMEA process, starting off as a resident of the main homeless shelter nearby. He quit drinking and found a job while at CAMEA, and later moving into his own apartment in Cheyenne.
COVID hit. I started going blind, and it was pretty terrible, but I was paying my bills and making it and everything.
Then a new company bought the apartment complex he'd lived in for the last 10 years.
New management came in and took over, and they more than doubled my rent, and that was like 1.5 times my disability check.
For a while, it seemed the only option for him would be to live on the streets once again.
Oh, my heart fell out of me. I felt lost. I felt, what am I going to do? What am I going to do with all this stuff? Where am I going to do? Where am I going to go? How am I going to live?
He got lucky and was offered an apartment at Stages. He says he feels at home here. And he just got a new neighbor.
I'm Tom. I'm from California.
Tom Sullivan says he became disabled around 6 years ago.
And then, before COVID, I started traveling around. I went to all the western states. I was in Florida. I was trying to find senior housing. I was approved for senior housing, but I couldn't find one.
He took Greyhound buses from state to state, looking for a place that would take him in, eventually landing here in the CAMEA shelter. When he applied to be an upstairs resident of the main shelter, Sullivan says the staff asked him,
if you're denied your application to go into be part of the second stage of the program, what would you do? And my answer was, get back on the bus.
But he made it through. Now he's living in the Stages program with his kitten, Frisky.
He's on radio meowing on people, interviewing.
While local shelters like CAMEA are taking solutions into their own hands, an interim committee of the Wyoming legislature is thinking of their own.
A specific solution that was proposed in our committee is this idea of tax incremental financing.
That's Lander Senator Cale Case, chairman of the Joint Corporations Committee. The idea he mentioned, also called TIF, takes blighted or undeveloped areas and provides money to the developer by loaning based on the increment of taxes to come in the future. The hope would be to draft a bill to allow those funds to subsidize affordable housing as well. But the potential committee sponsorship of a TIF bill in the next session comes with its own complexities.
In our Constitution, we're not supposed to loan our credit to private entities, but that's been circumvented in times when there's a public purpose.
The argument, Case says, is that using tax incentives to increase affordable housing is in the public's interest. As lawmakers continue working on potential solutions and local groups do their part, it's clear that for now there won't be an easy fix. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements.
Shed antler hunting season in Wyoming opened on May 1st. Hunters typically come to Jackson from all over to search for the antlers. That's because at this time of the year, elk begin dropping their antlers. But this year, only Wyoming residents could participate for the first week, thanks to a new state law. Even though there were fewer people, competition was still fierce. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Filippula Inkney tags along with hunters near the National Elk Refuge.
The sun has yet to rise, and over 100 cars, trucks, and trailers sit idling in the county fairgrounds parking lot and down the neighboring street. Hunters are drinking coffee and some saddling horses. Then, 20 minutes before the 6 a.m. start of the annual shed hunt, flashing police lights lead the motorcade out of town toward the elk refuge. Brady Rivenez and his five shed hunting passengers are 23rd in line. As he drives, his black truck's headlights glance off herds of elk. The 24-year-old from Gillette says the rush, or the chaos, as he puts it, is hard to explain.
Especially since it's over something stupid like elk horns.
But this is Rivenez's fifth year driving the 6.5 hours from Gillette for the shed hunt, and he knows where he's heading. He quickly hangs a right, leaving the motorcade, peels down a gravel road, veers over the edge of it, and lurches into park beneath looming canyon walls just outside of the refuge boundaries. The group leaps out of the truck, swings packs over their shoulders, and breaks into a sprint alongside other hunters, like the start of an Easter egg hunt for grown men clad in camo.
It's exhausting. This is the definition of type 2 fun.
The annual shed hunt in Jackson usually draws hundreds of vehicles from around the country. But with the new state law, out-of-state residents now have to wait a week to hunt. The legislation was largely spurred by Wyoming shed hunters who felt they'd been pushed out by swarms of hunters in recent years as the sport has grown in popularity. This year, Game and Fish's Brad Hovengay says the legislation cut the number of registrations in half.
And quite honestly, it was about as low-key as a antler collection opener as we've seen here in years.
In years past, Game and Fish has found hunters trying to get an advantage by sneaking out early, which is illegal. But this year, law enforcement didn't cite anyone. And Hovengay says they checked license sporadically and didn't find anyone violating the new law. But he says the department has heard from many non-residents who felt the law making them wait is unfair.
Non-residents this show may have to hunt quite a bit harder than they have experienced in the past when they were allowed to start on the 1st of May.
Jace Romrell from Start Valley says he's a fan of the law.
It's more special this year because we can actually benefit from being, you know, Wyoming residents, and it makes me feel proud to be able to come pick up the antlers that you watch all winter long and you see on the refuge, you know.
Sitting atop his horse with antlers slung to its side, he says this year is also special since his sons are joining him for the first time.
My goal was to get the twins, my two boys, an antler, and they both succeeded in that. So I just wanted to put a smile on their face and make them enjoy the outdoors just as much as I do. And we were able to get up there and get the antlers that we were after. So,
he says he's been shed hunting in Jackson for about 10 years.
We enjoy looking at them. We enjoy using them in home decor. They're special to us because it's a Western living style, you know.
Brady Rivenez, the 24-year-old from Gillette, says he has mixed feelings about the new law.
Yeah, I kind of go both ways. It's cool being able to see all the Wyoming guys get first pick on horns, but also kind of bittersweet because you don't get to see all your buddies you've made over the years from coming to this.
Back on the mountain, Rivenez runs up a rocky cliff to a ridgeline that plateaus. The sunrise casts a pink glow above the Tetons and glistens off the thin snow crust.
It's gonna be a little hard to see with the snow.
Moving fast, with no plans of stopping, he knows other hunters are right behind him. He's looking for pockets or clusters of many antlers.
Some years you find it, some years you don't. But either way, we're not stopping.
Then his pace quickens and he yells as he spots one, then two. He scrambles to their side, throws off his pack, straps them in, and with no time to celebrate, keeps moving, unsatisfied.
Not good enough. For where we went through to only have two, it's surprising.
By the end of the day, he'll have added two more, and his friends, who all spread out, found another four.
Not too shabby.
He's had better years, but ultimately it's not just the thrill, the sheds, or the scenery that keeps him coming back.
A lot of it's the people. We like to shed hunt. There's sheds on this hill. Everyone else gets to come together that likes to shed hunt. You get to see all those guys pick up horns. It's just a good time in general.
Rivenez returns to his truck and throws down his sheds, considering their size and debriefing the day cordially with other returning hunters. The competition is now over. Then he grabs a quick lunch in town and hits the road back towards Gillette, all before noon. Dante Fopola Inkney, KHOL News.
Coming up next on Open Spaces, why some tribal members are pushing for tuition waivers for Native students at the University of Wyoming. Stay with us.
This is Classical Wyoming, with great music 24 hours every day. If you would like to see the playlist, go to classicalwyoming.org.
The Wyoming Public Radio app delivers great music 24/7. Stream Wyoming Sounds, Jazz Wyoming, and Classical Wyoming. Download the Wyoming Public Radio app at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. The University of Wyoming is a land-grant institution. That means it largely got its start on land taken from Native peoples. Many of these schools continue to benefit from those lands today. Recently, some schools have started free tuition waivers for Native students as a way to acknowledge this history. I chat with Wyoming Public Radio's tribal affairs reporter, Hannah Haberman, about recent efforts from tribal members to adopt the same practice at UW. So, Hannah, the idea of tuition waivers came up in front of lawmakers at a recent Select Committee on Tribal Relations meeting in Fort Washakie. What was brought up? What was talked about?
Yeah, so right now, the University of Wyoming does not currently offer a tuition waiver for Native students. And at this most recent meeting, Eastern Shoshone Tribal member James Trosper said the request isn't a new ask.
Both business councils have expressed interest for many years in the possibility of a tuition waiver for Native American students at UW to alleviate at least partly the financial burdens faced by these students, which in some cases can prevent them from pursuing higher education.
You know, the tribes have tried to bring this up before. In 2018 with the University of Wyoming's Board of Trustees, again in January this year, and now in front of lawmakers. And for the most part, it seems like there's confusion about who can even make it happen.
Okay, so let's back up a step. Why do tribal members say waivers for Native students are necessary, and what's the basis for the ask?
Right, so this actually goes back to the mid-1800s, when Abraham Lincoln signed the Morrill Act. It took land that had been recently taken from tribes for very little to no money, then divided that land up and gave it to institutions like universities to sell or make money off to get started. And as you said at the top, those are land-grant universities, and UW is one. But these universities continue to profit from stolen Native land in the form of leasing state trust lands for things like grazing or oil and gas development. Earlier this year, I interviewed two of the folks at Grist who looked into this topic. Editor-at-large Tristan Ottone said the University of Wyoming continues to get a lot back from these lands.
Our data shows that University of Wyoming benefits from a combined about 223,000 acres. We have established that that land was taken from about 22 different indigenous nations, and that between fiscal year 2018 and 2022, Wyoming made about $5.4 million off of those lands.
Okay, and how are land-grant universities responding? Are they acknowledging this history or taking any sort of tangible action?
You know, some land-grant universities have offered waivers for Native students for decades. But in the past few years, there's been more and more reporting on it, and as this data about land-grant universities has gained traction, it's raised questions about whether these universities have any sort of obligation to give back to Native residents or Native students.
And you mentioned that some universities offer waivers already. Where and how has that worked?
In the last few years, big schools like the University of California system and the University of Arizona made headlines when they launched these tuition waiver programs. A lot of these schools often have stipulations about being part of a federally recognized tribe or living in state. But some places have been doing this for a long time. I was really surprised to find this out, but the University of Maine has had a tuition waiver since the 1930s, and public colleges in Montana have been doing it since the 1970s.
Wow, okay, so just north of Wyoming for over, like, 50 years. All right, so bring us back to what's happening in Wyoming. What else happened at that recent Select Committee on Tribal Relations meeting?
Yeah, so Trosper was joined by Northern Arapaho tribal member Allison White Eagle. She is currently a student at the University of Wyoming College of Law. She said that in 2018, representatives from both tribes approached the UW Board of Trustees to ask for a waiver. The board wanted to know more.
They wanted information on things like retention rates of Native students, graduation rates of Native students. What was the cost of a tuition waiver going to look like for the university?
White Eagle did some research over the last year to try and answer those questions. She found that less than 1% of students at UW reported to be Native American or Alaskan Native. That's definitely less than the 4% of the state population that has some sort of tribal affiliation. And retention and graduation rates have remained consistently low in recent years. I should say here, though, that because there are relatively few Native American students, rates fluctuate a lot from year to year.
I'm curious, what kinds of funding sources already exist for students who are tribal members? Did she talk about that at all?
Well, she talked about the state-funded Hathaway Scholarship, which provides a full ride for both Native and non-Native students. But not everyone qualifies. There's an ACT threshold you have to meet and some other academic and financial requirements. White Eagle said there are 15 scholarships at UW designated exclusively for Native students. The main three are the Chief Washakie Endowment, the Northern Arapaho Endowment, and the Northern Arapaho Sky People Endowment. These are primarily funded directly by the tribes, but again, they don't cover everyone.
What we found was the amount of applicants far exceeded the availability of scholarship monies. There were more applicants to the scholarship than what was available, so a lot of students missed out.
She also added that, according to UW's Office of Financial Aid, for Native students who did receive scholarships, less than half of their need was met during the 2023 to 2024 academic year.
Interesting. And what was the response from the committee members at the meeting?
Well, that kind of brings us back to the main question. How would it work and who would make it happen? Navajo State Senator Afi Ellis asked for clarity about whether UW had been looking into the idea since the tribe's request to the Board of Trustees in 2018.
I'm getting caught a little flat-footed. There's a lot of things I think that were happening and conversations happening I'm unaware of.
University of Wyoming Executive Vice President Kevin Carman said he believed the board's lack of action meant that they thought the waiver would be better pursued through the legislature. So right now, it sounds like everyone is just trying to get on the same page.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of confusion around who could actually make this happen. But was there any decision on what next steps might look like?
I'd say there was one main next step, which was get more information. In particular, Senator Ellis wanted to know more about how other universities fund their tuition waivers. Is it through university endowments? Is it set up by the legislature? The committee didn't endorse a free tuition waiver, but they did unanimously vote to send the committee's two co-chairs, Senator Ellis and Senator Oakley, to the next UW Board of Trustees meeting, which is scheduled for June 12th.
Okay, so the next steps connecting lawmakers with the university's trustees. Was there anything else to share on this topic?
Well, last summer, the Northern Arapaho Tribe and the University of Colorado Denver created a $50,000 scholarship for Northern Arapaho students, in recognition of the fact that that area is part of the tribe's ancestral homelands. It'll be available to undergrad students who are members of the Northern Arapaho Tribe starting this summer. So I guess it's just interesting to see what other schools are doing to support Native students moving forward.
Yeah, it is interesting. And thanks for sharing all this information and your reporting on the push for tuition waivers for Native students in Wyoming, Hannah Haberman. We really appreciate you.
You're welcome.
Stay tuned for a look at how posters advertising Buffalo Bill's Wild West show helped shape our understanding of the history and mythology of the American West. This is Open Spaces.
Hi, Daryl Brogdon here, host of the Retro Cocktail Hour, inviting you to join me for the music that's always served up shaken, not stirred. Whether it's TV crime jazz or tiki tunes, space age bachelor pad music, swinging soundtracks, or other incredibly strange music, it's on the Retro Cocktail Hour. Saturday night at 6 on Wyoming Public Radio.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Millions more people saw the posters that advertised Buffalo Bill's Wild West show than the performance itself. Posters with characters and scenes from the show were pasted on buildings and put up on fences, sometimes within a 200-mile radius of where the show took place. These posters offer a window into how the show helped shape the history and mythology of the West. Now, a new exhibit opening at the Center of the West also explores the challenges of preserving and displaying these posters that were printed more than 100 years ago. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats spoke with Buffalo Bill Museum Assistant Curator Sam Hanna about the careful steps taken to display the posters for the show.
Tell us about the poster exhibition. What's it about, and what are some of the topics that people will learn about when they visit?
Buffalo Bill's Wild West did much to shape the world's perception of the American West and, to a degree, America as a whole. To this day, there are some people who think that all Americans wear cowboy hats, and that's in no small part due to the images that were cemented into popular consciousness during the Wild West show's decades of touring around the globe. This exhibition will look at some of the themes presented by the Wild West show that served to create this lasting imagery associated with the West, and we'll examine the publishing history of the show's posters, and we'll also look at some of the challenges in caring for these works.
Great. So I know it's hard to pick a favorite, but I'd love to hear about what's one of the posters that you're excited about. Tell us about it. Give us a visual of that poster.
Well, thank you for not asking me to pick a favorite. But there are some that I find particularly interesting. At times, we see examples of different publishers sharing artwork, usually with simple changes to text, such as changes in language between U.S. and European printers. And the two that I'm specifically thinking of right now are a case of artwork shared by the Courier Company of Buffalo, New York, and the printer Wieners of Paris. And they depict Buffalo Bill reviewing various military personnel from around the world. What's notable about these posters is that the art is modified in the French version to place the French soldier more centrally in the image and closer to Buffalo Bill. I find these interesting because at first glance, they appear to be almost duplicates, but there are subtle differences upon examination that make them all the more special.
So Sam, I've heard you talk about these posters as works of art in and of themselves, and there's going to be more than 30 original posters that are on display. What really sets them apart visually?
These posters are what would herald the coming of the show. They were visually engaging with spectacular artwork. They drew the audience to the show. And these were likely the imagery that stayed with them long after they saw the spectacle. What really stands out for me, though, about these particular ones in the show is that some of them are, you know, on the order of 140 years old at this point, and they're still in wonderful condition. As ephemera, though, they were never meant to survive. They were never meant to stick around. They were meant to be torn down or posted over. So the fact that they're here is very, very special.
Tell us about what's challenging about conserving and preserving these posters. What kind of conditions or situations cause them to deteriorate?
The delicate nature of paper itself is the major challenge and the main challenge in preserving these posters. Exposure to light, especially sunlight, variations in temperature and humidity, and damage due to handling are our main concerns and the main things that we try to control.
The Buffalo Bill Center of the West has one of the largest collections of original Buffalo Bill posters. Sam, can you take us behind the scenes of the museum and tell us about how the museum cares for these posters in ways that help ensure that these posters last long into the future?
Our goal with all of our objects is to preserve them for as long as possible so they'll be available for future generations. To care for them, we manage the factors that we were discussing earlier. Light levels are kept to a minimum, and exposure is minimized during non-viewing hours. Temperature and humidity are closely monitored and controlled, and care is taken to handle objects properly and only when required.
Do you ever get the question of, why doesn't the museum display these posters all the time? Why can't you just come in and see all these posters?
We are asked very frequently about works that a guest may have seen on display in the past, and hopefully sections of this exhibition will answer that. Regular rest in the darkness of our vaults is a necessary part of our care for works on paper, such as posters.
So when you talk about that resting period, what does that look like as far as how long things are on display and then how long they typically rest for?
Our goal is to rest an object for 2 years after 6 months of display time.
when people come to the exhibition and learn about some of the challenges of preserving these posters, what do you hope they take away?
We very much hope that people come away with a greater appreciation of these works and some of the stories they tell. And as much of this applies to documents, photographs, and more, we hope that they may be able to take home some tips that will help them better care for some of their own treasures. Techniques to limit light exposure and selection of materials that will help them better handle and store their objects at home.
The exhibition, called Advertising the Frontier Myth, Poster Art of Buffalo Bill's Wild West, opens on May 18th. People will get to see these posters up close, and it sounds like there's also some interactive components to it. Tell us about that.
In the section about care of paper, people will be able to closely examine a poster using a flashlight and magnifying glass and search for and identify various types of damage to the paper. They will also be able to view digital images of posters that are not currently on exhibit, and they'll even be able to join the show by including themselves in a Wild West poster.
Wow, that sounds so fun. Thanks, Sam, for joining us. Sam Hanna is the curatorial assistant of the Buffalo Bill Museum, and he co-curated a new exhibition on posters used to advertise Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Melody Edwards, today's audio producer, and Ivy Engel, our digital and social media producer. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.